that's a good idea or bad.
It's noisy.
It would be noisy.
Yeah, it'll be noisy. We'll leave it closed. Okay. I'm Richard Swanson. I teach religion, philosophy, classics, whatever they let me do. If anyone comes in and sits down, I'll teach them something. At Augustana College, Sioux Falls, South Dakota. And above all, what I am fascinated by, and have been fascinated by since I was a little kid, are stories. I come from a storytelling family, I guess. I just thought I came from a normal family, but maybe everybody's family does. But I come from a family that had some astonishingly good storytellers. My mother's mother, in particular, was this great old Swedish lady with a lap that you could, practically the whole neighborhood could snuggle down into her lap. And when you snuggled down into her lap, you snuggled way in, and then she would tell stories. I grew up on biblical stories. My family didn't, for the most part, tell fairy tales. I actually had to read them to hear them first. It makes my upbringing a little bizarre. But I grew up on stories out of the Bible. And I remember still the day my grandmother was telling stories. She was telling the story of Daniel in the den of lions. I was snuggled down in her lap, and she was telling the story. She was telling it partly because it was my second favorite story. My favorite story was the one with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, because I had practiced saying those names. So she would tell the story, and then she'd say, "And who were the Jewish people in that story?" And I would say them, and she liked that. But she was telling Daniel in the den of lions, and I was happy. And then I realized that as she told the story, I could smell the lions. I have no idea how she did that, but there was something about her way of telling stories that in fact made it so utterly convincing that I could smell the lions. It is probably the case that my entire career is the result of that one day telling stories, because I've spent my career trying to figure out how she did that. I don't know how she did that. She's dead now, many years, so I can't ask her. But I have seen other storytellers who can do the same thing, and I study that. What we're going to do today, and we're going to do it fast, we've got 1 hour, we're going to think overall about why we tell stories. That's a very simple question, and it probably has some simple answers that are, in fact, complex. It has some complex answers that are probably simple, but we're going to play with that. And I'm going to suggest a few possible answers to it. We're going to look a little bit at Jews and Christians and their stories. You'll notice, looking at the blackboard, that I got straight C's in handwriting, and it didn't get better with graduate school. So I'm going to tell you what's up there, because you can't possibly read my handwriting. My students tell me that all the time. I'm going to talk about Jews and Christians and their stories, because there's something about story and Jewish and Christian faith that belong together. And then we're going to look at what stories can do. I already told you, stories can make you smell lions. But I want to think about that in a somewhat orderly fashion, and I got a few things I'll drag out for you. I want to think what else stories can do. That's probably slightly more orderly. We're even going to talk about Aristotle when we get there, briefly. But we are. And then we're going to think about the matter of scripture and story as a place to at least close what we're talking about and get ready to leap into the next things that I'll be doing the rest of this week. So, Jews and Christians and story. One of the things that fascinates me, I teach religion in a part of the country where a great many people are from church-going backgrounds. It's a marvelous thing. But they come in with all sorts of fascinating ideas about what it means to read the Bible. And at least right now, in the current religious climate, there are an awful lot of people that come to college having been taught absolutely that the Bible gives you information that you need to live right, think right, be right. And being right is really important, because you have to be right because everyone else is wrong. And that's just good to know. So the Bible helps you be right and know how everyone else is wrong. And it does that by giving you the right information that no one else has. This causes a bit of trouble, but it is in fact a common reaction. You may have met people that understand the Bible gives them information that no one else has. That's interesting to me. But if the Bible is solely a book of information, why in the world did Jews, and after them Christians, tell so many stories and make so many stories scripture? Because there are far better ways to convey information than in a story. Stories are wonderfully inefficient ways of conveying information. In fact, if you go to the doc, she doesn't have a story in your file about you. She's got lists of information. Lists are great ways to convey and remember information. But your doc doesn't have stories. She has lists because they work better. So why didn't Jews and Christians use lists to remember essential religious information? Well, first of all, they did. We have vast stores of lists out of the ancient world, and some, well, one anyway, made it into something that at least made a bid to be scriptural. Anybody read the Gospel of Thomas? The Gospel of Thomas is really cool. It's a numbered list. Yep, no bugs here. At least as far as I know. The Gospel of Thomas is a list. It probably should have a subtitle, Stuff Jesus Said, because it is a numbered list of 114 different sayings of Jesus. Every one of them has a number. So number 105. There's a little narrative lead-in, there's a snappy saying, and then a narrative fall-off. 106. One day Jesus was walking down the road and the disciples asked him, snappy saying, narrative fall-off, 107, all the way up to 114. If you've read the Gospel of Thomas, you will have noticed that at least some of the stuff in the Gospel of Thomas is pretty familiar. It looks a lot like things that, especially parable texts, a lot of the parable texts show up in some form in the Gospel of Thomas, in the list. So there is, there's the parable of the mustard seed, there's parables of this and parables of that. There's the parable of the lost sheep. You know the lost sheep? Which one of you having 100 sheep, losing one, doesn't go looking for it? The answer to that question is no one in their right mind. But never mind. The Gospel of Thomas has that too, with slight differences. There's a guy who has 100 sheep. He loses one sheep. It was the biggest one. And when he saw that he had lost his only large sheep, he abandoned the scrawny ones in the wilderness and hunted until he found the large one. And when he found the large one, he said to it, I love you more than all my other sheep put together. Now, it's recognizably the same story with some recognizable differences. Gospel of Thomas has more differences than that, though. My very favorite saying of the Gospel of Thomas is the last one, number 114. One day, Mary and the disciples were arguing about whether Mary had any place in the kingdom or not. And the disciples were very clear. She was a woman. She had no place in the kingdom at all, because there is no place in the kingdom for women. The disciples knew that. They were absolutely adamant about it. Peter argued. Everybody argued. And they looked her in the face and said, you know, it's really nice that you'd like to be part of the kingdom, but you're not because you're a woman. Jesus came up. They appealed to him. And Jesus says, well, Mary, I hate to tell you this, but Peter is right. Because you are a woman, you have no place in God's kingdom. But have no fear, I will turn you into a man. Wouldn't you love to go to church and have that read as the lesson of the day? I've always imagined that my mild-mannered Swedish mother would throw hymnals at anyone who dared read something like that in church. Gospel of Thomas is a list of sayings stuff Jesus said, some of which are odd, some of which are utterly ordinary. But the Gospel of Thomas did not make it into any official list of scriptural texts anywhere. It never shows up in a list of canonical books. It's excluded. Now, there's probably 100 reasons for that, but just to deal with two possible, it wasn't excluded because it was crazy. Have you read the Bible? Crazy doesn't keep stuff out of the Bible. The Bible's loaded with crazy. Gospel of Thomas is not too nuts to make it into the Bible. The reason the Gospel of Thomas is not in the Bible, I'll suggest for today, is because it's not a story. Jews and Christians have chosen narrative as a proper form for Scripture so vigorously that the biggest chunk of Scripture is narrative in form. Yes, there's a lot of Psalms, there's wisdom literature. A good chunk of that has narrative implication and is exactly narrative in form. I'm translating the book of Job right now. That's heavily narrative in form. Even the prophets have narratives embedded in them and implied behind them. For Jews and Christians, there's something about story that is appropriate for Scripture. And I'm willing to suggest, well, when you get to heaven, ask around. There probably are better reasons than this why Thomas was excluded. But I'm willing to suggest for today that it's because it wasn't a story. When the church, the Christian movement, the Jews who believed that Jesus was somehow significant and worth remembering, when they set out to officially remember Jesus, they did not do it in the form of a list, though they had the chance. They did it in the form of a story. They, in fact, did it in the form of four stories, which is a big deal, because they are four different stories. Yeah, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, they got different names. Well, no, if you've read them at all closely next to each other, you know that there are, in fact, really important differences amongst them. They have, all of them, some basic things that they share. At the end of the story, Jesus dies and rises. That's an important thing to share. The central character is named Jesus, and he's followed by a group of people that has many of the same names, though not all of them. But one of the things that's fascinating about this set of stories that are official remembrances of Jesus, they all agree that Jesus dies and rises at the end. But there is almost no part of the story about which they, around which they differ more than the business of his rising. The stories of how Jesus rises are all different. They are utterly different from each other, more than any other part of the story. That's interesting, because it appears to mean that even at the center of the story, the most important part where they're doing the heavy lifting, and no matter what you think, the dying and rising of Jesus is really the heavy lifting in the story, somehow or other. They differ most when they tell the story of his rising. That would appear to mean, by the way, that fundamentalism has a basic problem. Anything that imagines the Bible exists to give you information is going to have real trouble figuring out exactly what information counts when you get to the resurrection. How many people saw Jesus? A lot of people or nobody? Depends on if you're reading Matthew or Mark. In Mark, nobody sees Jesus at all. The other Gospels have him appearing to everybody. Which one is right? Yes. That's important. The stories are right in their disagreement. In fact, there is an ancient Christian writer, Irenaeus. You may have read him. He's worth reading. Interesting early Christian thinker who argues that there have to be four Gospels and they have to be different from each other. He says there has to be exactly four. Well, the Bible had four in it. That's why he knew there had to be exactly four. There's a little bit of squirrely argumentation goes on in any century. But he says they have to be different from each other. Why? For the same reason that the wind has to blow out of the north, the south, the east, and the west. That's worth thinking about. Irenaeus lived in a world that had boats without keels. And so if you wanted to sail to the east, you needed a wind that would blow you there. And if the wind always blew out of the east, all the boats in the world would pile up on the western shore, and they would be used for kindling. but you'd have to walk home again. That makes sailing somewhat impractical. Irenaeus said, in order to get everywhere that you've got to go, the winds have to be different from each other. The implication is that in order to get where you need to go with biblical story, with gospels, they have to differ, they have to disagree, because each one will take you different places. Ooh. That implies that the stories require us to ask of them, where is this taking me? What does this do to me? What does this contribute that nothing else does? We're going to look at that in more incoming sessions. We're going to look at a bunch of what the Gospel of Mark specifically contributes. But for right now, that's a big deal. There are lots of differences, including some itty-bitty little ones, like, so, on what day was Jesus murdered by the Romans? Was he murdered before Passover or after Passover?
Both.
Both? Yep, the answer is yes. Mm-hmm. What was Jesus' hometown? Did his mother and father live natively in Nazareth or Bethlehem? The answer is yes. Because in the Gospel of Luke, Nazareth is where Joseph had his business. And they travel because when Quirinius was the governor, yeah, you've all been in Christmas pageants enough, you can do the whole thing with Quirinius. You know that they traveled for the census so that they might be enrolled. You read the Gospel of Matthew lately? Gospel of Matthew, they live in Bethlehem. And they only leave because Herod launches a genocidal attack attempting to kill all the toddlers in and around Bethlehem, which means the Gospel of Matthew begins with all of Jesus' cousins being slaughtered, and he escapes barely, lives in Egypt, and then goes to Nazareth as a refugee. Does that change the story? Oh, somewhat rather. Four different stories. So, what can stories do? Hundreds of things, but I'm going to suggest three, because three's a nice number and I can hold three fingers up easy. First thing that stories can do, stories project worlds. They project worlds. When you read a story, something happens that is more than just the deciphering of little black marks on a white page. The deciphering of little black marks on a white page is a wonderful thing. But the little black marks on the white page blow a world up around you that envelops you, that makes itself into a real world around you. That's important. Okay, so I was about 12 years old. And I was reading. I did that a lot. I do it a lot now. I had the great good fortune to have found a job that I get paid to read. This is really nice. Good work if you can get it. I was reading, probably a mystery, because when I was 12, I read a lot of mysteries. I loved mysteries. And so I was lying in the living room reading, having a wonderful time. My mother was worried that I was not going to become well-rounded if I just read. She was probably right to worry. But she came into the living room and said, "Would you put that book down and go outside and play?" I said, "Mom, I can't. It's raining." Now, what you have to know about this story is, on the day in question, it was actually January 14th in southern Minnesota, and it was 20 degrees below zero outside. Where was it raining? In the book. Stories project worlds that envelop you so thoroughly that I believe. Now, it helps to be a nutsy reader. Anyone else here a nutsy reader, especially as a kid? Yes, so you get this for sure, yes. A nutsy reader, I was sure that it was raining. My poor mother, how she lived through raising me, I do not know. But the world enveloped me, and I was sure that I was in a world where it was raining. Ever gone to the movies and come out at the end of the movie and been surprised that it was daytime because the movie ended at night? It happens to me all the time. Stories project worlds. I've got friends that when they go for long drives, bring a book along, not a book on tape, a book on book, and they prop the book up in the steering wheel and read. If ever in your life you see me behind the wheel of a car with a book in the steering wheel, hide behind something made of concrete. Reinforced concrete is better, because if the story has a road in it and the road turns, I'm turning the steering wheel. Stories project worlds that are, to me, utterly persuasive. Second thing the stories do, they not only project worlds, they draw you into those worlds. It's sort of a special case of the first one, but it's really important. You ever sat down to read and decided you're just going to read for, you know, 15, 20 minutes until you get tired, and then you'll go to sleep? And you read, and boy, 15 to 20 minutes, you're just at a good part, so you read, you know, just to the end of the chapter. And so you read to the end of the chapter, and then you realize, oh, but, you know, I got to know what happens next, so you read, I'm just going to read the next section. No, you read the next, ever been reading like that and seen the sun come up? Why? Why did the sun come up and you were still reading? Could not put it down. Stories grab hold of you and pull you in. And if they get good, if they get their hooks into you, they don't let you go. Now, again, it helps to be a nutsy reader, but this happens to everybody at some level. So when you read a story, what is it that pulls you in? What things hook you when you read?
The surroundings and the people.
Yes. There are pieces that I read, there are books that I read just because they describe the world so beautifully. Sometimes they describe a place that I've been lots of times and I just want to go back. Other times they describe places that I've never ever seen, may never ever see, but this lets me see them. Yes?
Yes. The ending.
Yes. Why the ending?
You want to know what happens. Yeah. Well, sometimes you quit reading and read the end first.
Yes. Or have you ever been reading a book that you just came to love and love and love? Big, thick thing about like this. And as you read into the last sixth of the book, you slow down because you realize as soon as it ends, you're good. Yes. Mm-hmm. Stories draw you in with a promise of an ending, which, by the way, is what we're going to do with Aristotle. That's a big deal, endings for Aristotle. They pull you in with a promise of an ending that you sometimes don't want the book to cash in on. Yes? Other times you've got to find out what's going to happen, because the ending is the part that's going to make the story work. Stories make endings powerful by creating a need in you for there to be an end to this story. Stories create problems that make you need to have a resolution. That's a big deal, by the way, because it means that we use stories to try out resolving problems that we can't find resolution to in the regular world. That's a big deal. What else hooks you and pulls you into stories?
The intrigue.
The intrigue. How so? Do you have an example?
Just, it's like a whodunit.
Yes. And the fact that they call that whole genre a whodunit means that, in fact, the story has to set you up to need to know who done it. What else hooks you?
Identifying the character.
Yes. Sometimes because the character is admirable, mm-hmm. and this is someone that I might love to grow up into. Sometimes because the character is despicable, and I'd kind of like to be despicable sometimes. Truth be told, everybody wants to experiment with being despicable and not have to go to jail for it. Sometimes stories help you with that. Yeah. Anything else? Yes.
Sometimes the words are so beautifully put together.
Yes. Do you have a particular writer that's that way for you?
Oh, I have to work to pull one up for you, but it happens.
Oh, because it just does. Has anybody read Dorothy Sayers' mystery stories?
Yes.
That woman could just flat out write. Who's read the Lord Peter Wimsey books? Oh, I love it. There are a couple of those that I read, even though I wasn't that interested in the story. Occasionally the stories were things that I didn't care very much about, but her language tasted so sweet that I would read it just because it tasted good. Yes?
I'll tell you an odd one. Adam's book, Watership Down,
yes,
is a story about rabbits, for those who haven't read it. and you're reading along and the rabbits talk to each other and it has many layers to it. And I found myself partway through thinking, how did Adams know what those rabbits said to each other?
Yes, yes.
Grabbed me so much.
Mm-hmm. And so sometimes it's the beauty of the language, but it's also the beauty of the inventiveness. This storyteller has found a way to crack open a world that I wouldn't have thought to crack open. And now I'm listening to rabbits talk. Every once in a while, you ever stop in the middle of a book and wonder why you are inside this world with rabbits talking? Yeah. Storytellers crack open worlds that you couldn't be part of otherwise. That's a piece.
Stories are also convinced that life is meaningful.
Yes.
And so the why of whatever is going on comes through.
And that's one of the most important things with the matter of the ending. Because stories, and here, I'm leaping partly ahead. I'll do this more thoroughly in a second with Aristotle. But the business of stories beginning and ending is huge. Because the middle is the place that makes you demand an ending. But you know that one is coming. This will be resolved. And that's really important. It means that stories are, in fact, a tool we use to try out solving the insoluble. Because in a story, every problem is posed in a narrative setting. But anything you can pose in a narrative setting by implication can be solved inside that narrative setting. And so we use stories to try things out. So my daughter, a very good reader, she was about 6 years old or something like that, and she'd read the Willy Wonka books with a glass elevator. Anyone know that story?
Mm-hmm.
And so she was telling me the story of the story, and she was having a good time, a glass elevator that go up high. And I said, so does the elevator then just go right out to the top of the building and go right out into outer space and go all the way to the moon? And she said, Dad. I said, and then does it just stay there? And she said, Dad. And I said, well, what's wrong? Why wouldn't an elevator just go up and stay? And she said, what do you want? They're all going to die? The elevator has to come back down. Or the problem that was posed wasn't solved. Now, she was six, but she was not a bad literary critic at the time. You don't put an elevator up unless that elevator comes back down. She said, otherwise, it would be boring. Now, of course, 6 years old through about 16, everything is boring. It's required to be. But what she meant was the story would be incomplete. The problem wouldn't reach its ending, and that would be, in her terms, at six, boring. Okay, stories project worlds. They draw you into those worlds. Here's the one that, in my years of trying to figure this out, has always been hardest. Stories create roles and expectations and ways of seeing the world. Now, when I do that with students, I check what they think I mean by that. And they usually imagine that stories create roles means that inside a story there's a good guy and a bad guy, a protagonist and an antagonist, a helper and an opponent, all of those things. And all of those are really important, but that's not what I mean. When I say stories create expectations, they generally talk about the intrigue or the suspense that goes on in a story. I know something's going to happen, it's hanging over my head, it's going to drop on me. That's really important, but it's also not what I'm meaning. Ways of seeing the world, they usually suppose that that's because stories project worlds, you get a way of seeing that. Well, that's true and important, but what I mean is different. Stories create roles and expectations and ways of seeing the world that you discover inside the story, but then you carry with you, right about here in your brain, outside the story. Stories create roles and expectations and ways of seeing the world that you carry outside of the story into the world that you think you live in. So, when I was a kid in my hometown, which when I was a little kid I lived in Lake Benton, Minnesota, and we got 2.5 channels on the television, 2 channels mostly, and one that every once in a while we could get, and we'd watch it carefully just to see if in the snow there was actually a picture. I see someone moving. No, it's just snow, my mother would say. But on one of the channels, on Saturday morning, it was from 7 in the morning until 10, cowboy shows. All cowboy shows. And so we would watch Fury, My friend Flicka, which was always funny because I come from a Swedish family, so my mother would say, you realize that means girl. Yes, mother, I know that. My friend Flicka, Roy Rogers, my favorite Red Ryder, because I had a Red Ryder jean jacket that I would wear while we watched Red Ryder on the television. We watched all of them, and all of my friends watched them. 10 o'clock, cowboy shows were done, and we went out and met in the vacant lot next to Kevin Lau's house, and we played cowboys, of course. Now, if you played cowboys, many of you are of an age where you would have. My students these days mostly played Ninja Turtles and Power Rangers and things like that. It's really the same game without the hats, but or horses, usually. We met and we played cowboy. And if you played cowboy, you know that there are certain rules for cowboy life. First is, you got to be able to ride and rope and shoot. You also got to say it that way. So we'd meet and all of us could ride and rope and shoot, because cowboy world required that you be able to ride and rope and shoot. You need to know, however, that roping would be hopelessly beyond me then and now. Shooting, my father quit hunting before I was old enough to ever learn, so I can't shoot now or then. At that point, none of my friends had ever held a rifle. But when we played cowboy, we could shoot the eye out of a squirrel at 300 yards. Why? The story required that competence and created it in us. And as far as riding goes, I have, at this point, been on a horse 7 times in my life, and up to this point, the horses have not been amused. But when we met in the vacant lot, a bunch of dumb kids from southern Minnesota, every one of us could ride, every one of us could rope, and every one of us could shoot. Now, there's more to being part of cowboy world, though, because in cowboy world, there's something that always has to happen. People, first of all, gather in a group, rather like this one, and just want to live peaceable-like, remember? Yep, they just want to live peaceable-like. You also have to say it that way. But when people try to live peaceable-like, what happens in cowboy world? Terrible danger erupts. Someone comes and takes advantage of the people that just want to live peaceable-like. Terrible danger erupts. And when terrible danger erupts, things go very, very wrong. So in the face of terrible danger, someone has to stand up and do what's right. You also got to say it like that. So we'd meet out in the vacant lot next to Kevin Lau's house. We'd play cowboy. We'd all try to live peaceable life. And all of a sudden, terrible danger would erupt. Sometimes it was Fred Hall that was the terrible danger. Sometimes it was Kevin Lau. Sometimes it was Mike Crick. Sometimes it was me. We took turns. We didn't decide, okay, you've got to be terrible danger this week. We just knew it had to happen. And terrible danger would erupt. Things would go horribly wrong. And then someone would stand up and do what's right. Someone would sacrifice themselves. Someone would take terrible risks. Someone would protect people at great cost. Someone would act nobly. How did we know how to act nobly? We were dumb kids from southern Minnesota. We didn't know noble from a hole in the ground. How did we know to act nobly? The stories created the roles, the expectations and the ways of seeing the world. They created the ability to act nobly, at least in the vacant lot. And so week after week, we were noble as it was possible to be, and we practiced. Now, if that were the end of it, that'd be a pretty big deal. And there's probably even a good, probably a good dissertation in there somewhere about the influence of fantasy narrative on children's play. There's probably a really good study there somewhere. But the thing that's interesting for what we're trying to talk about today is that it doesn't end there. We didn't stop being cowboys when we left the vacant lot. And in fact, I probably haven't stopped being a cowboy yet. You carry that little set of roles, expectations, and ways of seeing the world with you into the rest of your life, too. So, we go to a faculty meeting. Everybody in the faculty meeting is just trying to live peaceable life, because that's all anybody on faculty wants to do, is live peaceable life. In the middle of everyone trying to be peaceable like or grade papers, whatever they're trying to do, terrible danger erupts. Ever been to a faculty meeting? Terrible danger erupts. And so we're sitting there trying to figure out what to do. And all of a sudden it occurs to me that somebody's got to stand up and do what's right. At which point my colleagues look at each other and say, it's just Swanson being a cowboy. Again. And they're right. There is a little cowboy that created roles and expectations and ways of seeing the world that I carry with me. So do you. And it is a useful thing for you to figure out what stories have shaped the roles that you find yourself playing. What stories have shaped the expectations that you come to life, to interaction with? And what stories have shaped the way you see the world that you think you live in? Because stories do all of those things for all of us. The difference is some people haven't thought about what those might be. Okay, what else can stories do? Now we're going to do that little bit of Aristotle. The big thing that stories do, says Aristotle, is they begin. That sounds really dull. Anybody read Aristotle's Poetics? This is a nice piece. This is actually really worth a read. And I think you should read all of Aristotle just because it's worth your time. But if that sounds like a hobby roughly at the level of watching paint dry, read the Poetics, because it is perhaps the oldest existing piece of the study of literature that we have, the study of what stories do. He's talking about tragic stories performed, but he's talking about what stories do. And he says, at one point, what is it that constitutes a proper story? Aristotle asks the simplest questions. And he says, a proper story is that which has a beginning, a middle, and an end. Now, when I have my students read Aristotle, they mostly come a little afraid that Aristotle is going to be too hard, because they know Aristotle is the foundation of modern philosophy, of an ancient philosophy, and medieval philosophy. They know that Aristotle is Aristotle, for Pete's sake, so they expect it to be difficult. One of these years, I'm going to require my students, before they get to read the Poetics or whatever else I make them read, to buy a rubber stamp in the bookstore. And the rubber stamp will have one word on it and one word only. And that word is, duh. Because in fact, Aristotle all the time says things that are flat-footed obvious. What's a proper story? It's something that has a beginning, a middle, and an end. At which point everybody should say, one, two, three, duh. They should stamp that in the margin of the book. Aristotle says, what constitutes a proper beginning? Ah, he says, a beginning is that before which there is nothing and after which there is everything. One, two, three. What is a proper ending? Ah, says Aristotle, a proper ending is that before which there is everything and after which there is nothing. Duh. And he does also answer, what's the middle? It's everything between the beginning and the end. Duh! I want my students to stamp duh by all of those things, so that then when they go to study for the exam, the only parts they should read are the parts with duh stamped by them. Aristotle talks about the significance of R sounds in the Greek language. He talks about plays that they will have never heard of, plays that we don't even know what they are anymore. He talks about all kinds of things, but at the end, his simple recognition, this beginning, the middle, and the end, is so flat-footedly simple that it is radical and significant. Why? Because by saying that a story has a beginning, a middle, and an end, he has just said that it is utterly unlike real life. Because in real life, there are no beginnings. And there are no ends. You believe that? How long have you been at Holden Village? Surely there was a beginning to your time here. When did you arrive?
Yesterday.
Yesterday. Had you been here before?
Yes.
Ooh. So your time at Holden Village began before that. When was the last time you were here?
40 years ago.
Your time at Holden Village didn't begin yesterday. It began 40 years ago. When did you hear about Holden Village before that?
Probably 2 years before.
Mm-hmm. You trace it back, you trace it back, it keeps going back. I ask my students, when did you, I often teach Aristotle to Frosch. He said, when did you start going to Augustana College? And they said, well, in the fall, you know, about a month ago. Ah, so one day you were walking down the street, you happened to see a set of buildings, you walked in and sat down and said, oh, I'm going to college, who knew? No, it starts before that, it starts before that, it starts before that. I asked when they first heard about Augustana College. Did you have parents that went to the school? One time I had a student who had great grandparents go to the college, and every generation in between had. When did that kid start going to that school? It recedes further and further back. Real life is like that. But relationships. Relationships must surely start at some point. My wife and I have, as of just a few days ago, been married for 37 years. So our relationship must be 37 years old, right?
No.
No, because I did not one day wander into a church, see a woman in white, and say, oh, I'd like to marry her. Although it would have been a good enough reason to have seen. Oh. But back before that, of course, was the deciding to get married, and back before that was the wondering about getting married, and back before that was the realizing that it was really nice to date this person, and back before that was the wondering if I ever dared ask her out. And back before that, everybody sometimes says, oh, but at some point you met her. That's the beginning of your relationship. The problem is, my wife was my sister's best friend. I have no idea when I met her, because she was just always there. I do remember the very first words I said to my future wife. I was a senior in high school eating in the cafeteria. My sister, 2 years younger, and several of her friends came to sit across from me because I was a cool older brother and, you know, you just needed to be in the presence of a cool older brother. So that, no, my sister said, no, actually there were no other seats. But they came and sat across from me. And I figured I should be cool and suave. And I look across and I see people that I can be cool and suave for, so I did my very best. I saw this one young woman, blonde colored hair, and I thought, I think I must have seen her before. I wonder what her name is. And I said, I should say something really cool and suave that would be kind and memorable. So I looked at my future wife and said, you should eat your cheese. It will make you constipated. I did. You can ask my wife. Notice, though, that the beginning of the relationship in real life recedes into infinity, finally. But if I tell you the story of our relationship beginning with eat your cheese, it'll make you constipated, that beginning creates a whole set of expectations, like 37 years of rolling your eyes and saying, I can't believe he said that. Oh, yes, he did. Ask my wife. Where you begin the story creates a whole set of possibilities that would not be there otherwise. I could tell you other stories about our relationship. They would begin at different points. We got married late in June in 1975. Late in June in 1975 in southern Minnesota, most houses didn't have air conditioning and no churches did. Late in June 1975, the afternoon of our wedding, it was 98 degrees with 95% humidity, which meant it was seriously hot. Fortunately, it cooled down by the time we got married at 7 in the evening. It was 97 degrees and 98% humidity by then. So my main memories of getting married are memories of sweating, which was, you know, something that we were doing a lot of. I was standing there sweating, and I noticed that the sweat would drip down from the small of my back and pool up on my belt. I was glad for my brown tux with a ruffled collar, because then no one would see the dark spot in the back of my shirt. That was a good thing. I was wondering if my wife was sweating, because she had a lovely dress, but it had to be warm. Then I noticed that our pastor was also sweating, which was interesting. Now, this is 1975. Everybody who was anybody wrote their own wedding services in 1975 because the Red Book had things like who giveth this woman and words like words that end in edst and eth. And I have a slight lisp, so I was glad we weren't using those things. We wrote our own service. It had things in it like, and thereunto do I plight thee my troth. Nobody knew what a troth was or how you plighted one. So we all wrote our own services. And we had written the whole thing down carefully with our pastor. He'd taken all notes on little 3x5 cards. And so I'm standing there in the front and notice that I'm sweating, and I wonder if my wife is sweating, and he's sweating. He's sweating more than I am because the sweat is dripping off his nose. Now, I had been reading some chaos theory and was puzzled by whether or not I knew already that you couldn't predict when a faucet would drip next because there are too many variables. Does the same thing pertain to sweat off a nose? I mean, when you're getting married, you have to keep yourself busy. You're supposed to not I'm staying busy up front, doing my level best to be a good citizen, and I'm noticing that the same thing applies. It's impossible to tell when the next, that's really nice to know. About two-thirds of the way through the service, he looked down at his 3x5 cards on which he had written with his cartridge pen in washable blue ink. And his eyes got big, and he showed us that the entire rest of the service, there wasn't a single readable word. It was an even blue wash. He said, "We're on our own. Follow me." And from that moment on, he made up the entire service out of his head. He made up responsive readings out of his... How do you make up responsive readings out of your head? But he did. When people got to the reception after, they said, "That was a lovely service you wrote." We said, "Yes, it was." Never knowing that, you know, we wrote one that we didn't do. And if I told you the story of our relationship starting at that point, notice how it implies very different things. It implies a whole lot of improvisation and a fair amount of sweating. That would also be a true story. But it's a different story. The story beginning creates the possibilities to be different. This matters because I told you that the ends of the Gospels are the most utterly different part. The other part that perhaps even is more different is the beginning. Gospel of Luke begins with angels singing, "Glory to God." Gospel of Matthew begins with dead toddlers littering the stage. Does it make a difference? If it doesn't, wow. The beginning creates the possibility of the end. The end is the place where everything that's tense in the story gets brought finally to ground. Best place. I have time to do this. Anybody here write stories? Do you find what I find, that the beginning is the hardest part? I've heard that from novelists who are friends of mine. I know it for me, even in the little things I write. Why is the beginning hard?
It's a variety of reasons, but mm-hmm. I think the beginning is hard because you don't necessarily know where you're going.
You don't. And my friends who are novelists say, you in fact shouldn't. You just follow the characters around and they tell you what they're going to do. But at the beginning, nobody's told you anything at all. Aristotle says that what happens in the beginning is that all the possible energy in the story explodes out into the world. Every possible character, every possible tension, every possible problem, every possible resolution is all present in the big bang of the beginning of the story. And when the story begins, it explodes. And you have to have a world that's whole and complete for people to step into and have something to stand on in just a little while. Ever been reading a story? You got books in your library that have markers in them that are 5 pages in, or 10, or maybe 25, and the marker has been there so long that the paper's gone yellow, the binding of the book has gone arthritic, and you couldn't open it. Why is that marker standing still?
It didn't pull you in.
It didn't pull you in. The beginning was, for me, not compelling. It didn't give me a place to stand. I went in and I fell down 20 stories. I'm not reading any more of that story, thanks. I went in and I realized, wow, this world is as boring as it's possible to be. And so I quit reading. The beginning is the place where all the energy has to flash out into existence. It flies in every direction, but it all has to be there or nobody keeps reading. What happens in the story, moment by moment, is that these bits of energy get pulled toward the end. Because in Aristotle, the end is not a stopping point, and it's not exactly a target. It's more like a huge magnet that pulls all of the energy in the narrative universe toward itself. And so the story explodes, and at one particular moment, the end reaches out and grabs this bit of energy and yanks it, turns it around, and yanks it straight toward the end of the story. Another moment, reaches out and grabs that bit, yanks it toward the end. Those moments of turning tell you how the rhythm of the story is going to be. It lets you feel how things are going to be resolved. One of the very best places to watch this is an American crime drama on television. Anybody here watch CSI, all of the alphabet soup stories? Yes? Mm-hmm. NCIS, that one we're currently addicted to in our family. Have you ever noticed that in those stories, crime mystery dramas, the story begins, it explodes out, there's a dead person, there's a body they find. They don't know what happened, they don't know why it happened, and they spend the first chunk of the story. The nice thing about American television is it's all broken up into 10-minute chunks. So the first 10 minutes is finding the body, then you have commercials. And then the next 10 minutes is the beginning to generate hypotheses about who killed whom, why. Are any of those hypotheses right? No. How do you know that? Well, it's only 20 minutes into the story. It's none of them are right. Next 10 minutes, they're doing the same thing. Half past, they've got some ideas, some of which might be possibly right, but they're none of them right. Have you noticed that at 20 minutes till, they have figured the entire mystery out? The person who did the murder is across town, and they dispatch all of their resources to go across town to apprehend the criminal. And meanwhile, they leave this person here in charge of the children and their bank cards and everything else they can think of that might be sensitive information because they know they can trust him. Is the person across town the murderer?
No.
No. Who's the murderer? The guy with the kids and the bank cards. At 10 minutes till, they suddenly realize that. And there's this last moment of turning, and the story is yanked hard toward its end. It is an Aristotelian beauty because it is Aristotle on a stick. American crime drama. The end reaches out and grabs bits of energy and pulls them in, and the story completes itself. Stories, therefore, give you a glimpse of how problems might be resolved by being pulled toward an ending where things can sit calmly. Now there's a bunch more we could do. But let me stop and just think with you a little. I said at the beginning that we need to think about what it is that stories are good for. What do they do? How do they transform you? Because it is the transformation that matters. When you watch a world that has murders in it and those murders are always solved, that transforms you into someone who sees the pain and then feels a need to find resolution. Crime dramas teach you, how do you find resolution? Well, back to Sherlock Holmes and way back to before that, you frequently find it by thinking clearly and rationally. The story has trained you to believe that if you can just think clearly enough and rationally enough, you can solve this problem. Anybody here read American hard-boiled detective stories? I got a friend who studies them. How do you solve things in an American hard-boiled detective story? Raymond Chandler, any of the others? Do you think hard? No, you just shoot people. There isn't any problem that couldn't be made better by just shooting some more people. Brutality solves problems. It's really important, therefore, that you pay attention to what this story is making you into. Does this teach you that when there's a problem in the world, what you need is more brutality, or more thought, or more gentleness, or more hope, or more, whatever? Or does this narrative world teach you that when there's a problem in the world, you're just stuck with it? That teaches you and transforms you into something else. Paying attention to that will help you figure out what it is that the story does. What do the Gospels do? We're going to talk about that in some detail, but just for right now, they all tell stories about a Messiah. A Messiah is one who takes an upside-down world and turns it right side up. The question is, how? The usual religious answers are not narratively informed. The usual religious answers have nothing to do with any of the Gospels. Just saying. You figure out what they do and how they transform you by paying attention to how the stories begin and how the problems develop and how the problems are solved. Gospel of Matthew poses a problem at the beginning. Which problem is, this is a world where people with power kill toddlers because they can. This is a world, in fact, even before the dead toddlers are on the stage. You read the genealogy in Matthew lately? You notice that there are women in the genealogy? Have you read what commentators have said about the women in the genealogy? They're sinners who are saved. Oh, come on. How badly do some of these people read? These are all of them people who have been pushed out of what was rightfully theirs, and they refuse to say push out. So Tamar is married off. Her husband treats her evilly and does what is evil in the sight of the Lord, and then he dies, which means he has to be really awful because God lets people get away with a whole lot in biblical narrative. This guy must have been in the Olympics of evil. So she gets passed on to the next brother so that she can be made pregnant and raise children to the honor of the first husband who was evil in the sight of the Lord so that God killed him. Remember how the story goes next? The story says, behind the background of the story is, as soon as her husband impregnates her, he's done doing his duty. And the wife is now a productive member of the family. She's given birth to someone who will help feed the family in the future. His duty is done as soon as she's pregnant. Ah, the storyteller tells you. Whenever he went into her, he withdrew and spilled his seed on the ground. How many times does it take to establish a whenever? Once? Yeah, once isn't enough. Because you could say, the time he went into her, he withdrew and spilled his seed on the ground. Now to say whenever, it's over and over and over again. He had realized he gets free access to her sexually as long as she's not pregnant. God killed him too. Tamar, having been sent home to her father, where she's an unproductive mouth, where she will be allowed to starve at the next famine, because life is hard in clans, Tamar is sent home, and she realizes that she has been wronged. Her father-in-law assures her, "No problem, honey. We'll send for you when the next son is old enough. Trust me on this." Would you trust him on this? No. Tamar dresses herself so that she would be mistaken for a prostitute. Her father-in-law sees her, and having apparently never paid attention to her, but he now notices her, he impregnates her. He left his wallet in his other robe, but he promises to pay her tomorrow. Trust me on this, he says. She doesn't care about being paid. She just takes the tokens of his promise. When she turns out to be pregnant, the family is in an uproar, and her father-in-law says, "You see what we put up with that evil woman living under our roof. You see how awful she was. You see what a problem she was for us. Oh, it just made us ache. I think we really do have to kill her." So they call her out. And just for form's sake, they say, "Who was it impregnated you?" And she says, "Well, I don't rightly know. But whoever it was, he owned these things." Judah's response at that point is not recorded. It probably isn't recordable. But it comes down to something like, "You're smarter than I am, honey." And he does finally what's right. The women in the genealogy are women who have been pushed out of what's rightfully theirs and they push their way back in. What happens when you start a story like that? Make it a story about the abuse of power and the necessity of resistance. The other Gospels start differently. Look at that. Think about that. Ask about that. And when on Thursday we play the St. Mark Passion for you, wonder, how does this story start? Why does it start that way? What tensions are created and how are they resolved? Because that will allow you to think about the transformation that happens in story. Thank you so much.